It is Saturday, November 30th, 2013. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KOSP Public Radio 88.9 and KOSP.org. It's time for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. I'm Lyle Troxell, a programmer, photographer, father, and radio host. And with me today in the studio in beautiful Santa Cruz is Ben Jaffe, a technology teacher, a musician, and web developer. Hi, Ben.
Oh, hey. How's it going?
It's good. And yourself?
I'm doing all right.
Good. Feels like the holiday season is upon us. I had a great time with my family the last few days, and I'm glad to be back in the States. I listened to a little bit of your show from Paris, which was a kick. I was with some people, and they said, "You do a radio show?" I was like, "Yeah." I looked at the time and subtracted 9 hours and went,
gosh.
"Hey, they're on the radio."
Wow, that's great.
So I turned on KOSP live stream, and that's why I said hi during the show.
Yeah. Did you eat too much this Thanksgiving?
No, I wouldn't say eat too much. I pay attention to that kind of thing to some degree.
Yeah. This is the first year that I have not overeaten, and it made me really happy.
I congratulate you, sir.
And I had two Thanksgiving dinners.
Why? Or is that not important for Geek Speak?
Actually, as a geek, I think about this. Like, why is it that if you have a lot of friends, you can actually attend multiple Thanksgiving dinners? Normally, you would say, okay, dinner is somewhere around 5 or 6 or 7, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But for some reason, I never really understood it. Maybe it's some social historical thing or whatever. Some people eat Thanksgiving dinner at 1
yep.
or noon or 2. So I had dinner at 1 or 1:30, and then I had dinner at 6. And I might have had another dinner, but I was too tired. So I took a nap at a friend's house, you know. It was good.
Yeah, it's good. I woke up in Paris, France on Thanksgiving morning. Then I flew to Frankfurt and then hung out in the airport for a while. Got some really good treats, and then I flew to the States. So it's a 9-hour difference, so, you know, 33 hours of Thanksgiving for me this year. Kind of fun.
Ooh, nice.
Yeah, not bad.
But I'm sure you were awake for all of it,
I was awake
right?
pretty much all of it, unfortunately. It was a very difficult day, but I'm fine now. But, you know, you have a TSA story, and since I was flying all over the place, can I jump you to that story, and we'll start by connecting the dots in that regard?
All right. The TSA. So we've all stood in the TSA Transit, I think it's Transportation Security Authority?
Sure.
We'll say that's what it is. So, Thanksgiving. Everyone's standing in line waiting for security.
Hey,
everyone
I was doing that.
Has to get to the airport 2 hours before if they're not going international, just in case, because, you know, Thanksgiving. And I was actually thinking, do you know if they actually run more flights on Thanksgiving? I imagine
I
they must.
The flight I was on was very full.
Yeah. So anyway, well, it turns out that they are just better than chance. their security, all of their security stuff, it's really sad. We spend so much money. I don't have stats in front of me about $1 billion on this program,
and it's slightly better than 50%.
It is just slightly better than chance. That's summarizing 400 studies over the past 60 years. It's not so great. So anyway, that's a bummer. That's the process of singling out people who look like they may be suspicious or, you know, all that stuff. And I should clarify. This is the screening of passengers by observation technique. They call it the SPOT program. And that's the pulling aside the suspicious individuals and searching them and everything. And it's just doesn't work very well. So,
okay. So I'll go ahead and tell a quick story about travel and Black Friday at the same time. Okay. So,
ooh, okay.
So when I was running out the door 2 weeks ago to go off for my travels for conferences and stuff, Maggie, my partner, handed me, some black pants that I was going to wear on stage. And so I threw them in the bag and I get on the plane and I go off to France and I pull out those black pants before the slacks, and there's a security tag on the foot of them, on the leg of them. Security
tag. We had to inspect these pants.
No.
This.
As in from the department store, or whatever she bought them, they had a security tag there so people wouldn't steal them, an RFID tag, and these things pierce through their clothing. You have to have a special device to take them off. I have tried opening them before, and it's not a messy. It was a very messy process. So I just ended up washing my clothes and drying them and everything in the hotel, so I didn't have to use those pair of pants. So when I got back today. This morning before the show, Maggie's looking for the receipts, couldn't find the receipts. So you can't really get these security tags removed if you don't have the receipt, because the whole point is they don't want you stealing merchandise. And if you didn't have the receipt, then maybe you stole it, which we didn't, of course. So I go online to start looking up how to deal with these things. And they're as simple as you put a high powerful magnet on one end of them at a certain configuration that lifts these beads and this little floating device that unlocks the mechanism. We tried for a long time with the magnets used in hard drives, the powerful magnets,
really,
right?
Yeah, really, really strong hard
drives. Couldn't get them to work. I was getting frustrated. I had to get off the show, and I just went downstairs and just cut them open with some clippers. The point was that sometimes these things have die packs, and sometimes they don't. Mm-hmm. Actually, most of the time, they don't have die packs. If the device has a thing on both sides, you pierce the clothing, and there's a thing on one side and a thing on the other side, that probably has a die pack. One side is the RFID transmitter, and the other ID, other side is the die pack. In either case, you could potentially, seal up the holes, protecting the clothing from cutting it. Mm-hmm. But I damaged the clothing even by cutting it, because the pressure it took to cut caused the plastic cap, a little push pin, if you will, to actually damage the clothing a little bit. Not in a bad way. Not like ink exploding on
it. Not really bad.
Right.
But
the point is, if you got one side, most likely it's not a die pack, and you can cut them off. And I recommend, if you do have to do that, if you decide to do that, instead of going back to the department store or whatever, take some time with it. Take some patience. And heck, film the thing and then put it up on YouTube, because they're really fun to watch these how to hack security tags from clothing videos.
More in security news. You know, usually we're talking about how to avoid being hacked, but I guess in some situations you end up
the mind that discovers how not to be hacked and the mind that discovers how to hack is the same mind. It's just devious or not, right?
Yeah. You know, as a kid, I used to think how much more not fun. See, I have to be careful the way I say this. It's easy to steal things from department stores. It's easy to get around security measures and, you know, this. Like, in the real world, it's easy to socially engineer your way backstage at a concert, you know? Like, all of these things that are not hard to do, and you can figure out how to do these online very easily. But having morals is, it's in some ways such a bummer, you know? I mean, like, thinking about it from having morals, of course, it's not a bummer. It's good that I have morals.
Yeah.
But if I didn't have morals, then I would be happy I didn't have morals.
Right.
And then would I be happier? I don't know.
I think it's fascinating, you know, when I'm going through security checkpoints at airports, of course, my geeky mind is going, how could I, figure out the system?
Yeah.
And I'm thinking that the entire time I'm going through. I'm thinking, can I wear Google Glass through the X-ray machine, through the shortwave resonating device? I did it once, no big deal. Another time they asked me to take them off. But the point is that it's not really consistent. The security theater that they do is not really consistent. It's actually not that good at what they do. At one point, I found this really fascinating thing. I'd gotten off an international flight, and I was still behind the security area where I could transfer to another plane. And at that point, other people had their luggage that was checked luggage, and they were walking past me. I'm thinking, wait.
Checked luggage.
So, you have checked luggage and non-checked luggage. I think it was in Frankfurt. And so the point being that if you have checked luggage, you can put something that's not appropriate for the plane, right? Razor blades or knife or something like that in your checked luggage. And that's what you have to do when you want your toiletries to have a pair of scissors or something, right?
Yeah, certain transfers between certain airports and certain international flights.
So I found myself walking by, while I could get on another plane, I was walking by people that had their checked luggage already, because they were going through customs.
So and they had to have.
Could have passed me something that wouldn't have been appropriate for a flight. It's like one of those things. Now the rules in outside the United States are different than inside the United States. But
that's true. But that's.
Are we doing geek speak, or are we just talking about ourselves?
I don't know.
Do we ever really know? I'm Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Ben Jaffe, and we are talking about tech news. Ben, what's your next story, sir?
Okay,
or is it my turn? I don't know. But go ahead.
You can go.
Please.
No.
Let's talk about some space news, shall we?
Okay, I want to talk about property rights on the moon. This is just a quick story. Basically, there was a 1967 international agreement. Basically, no, you can't own the moon, right? Because from whom do you buy the moon?
The moon.
Who do you claim the moon? Do you have to get there and then you can put a flag? I mean,
do
I guess
in that case.
Do
you have to put up residence?
Yeah, exactly. Well, there is this hotel tycoon, Robert Bigelow, and he made a whole bunch of money in the hotel and real estate business, and he's been pouring a lot of money, like hundreds of millions of dollars, into trying to create inflatable habitats for life beyond Earth.
Okay.
Which is kind of an interesting thing. But at the same time, it opens up a lot of interesting questions. Like, can you own a part of the moon? Can you own an area of the moon? So eventually, when we're able to go to the moon, if assuming...
And pop up an inflatable house.
Yeah, could you just have a gigantic inflatable hotel and then you own that property? And that just...
And what does it mean and all that? Yeah,
opens up a lot
could
of questions.
Could you start mining the moon?
Mm. Yeah, that's right? true. Yeah. That's true. So, basically he's saying, you know what? We should be able to own... We should be able to have exclusive property rights on the moon. I don't agree with him. He brings up some interesting points and arguments and whatever, but I ultimately disagree.
Well, I guess at some point, if we do take habitat, if humans take habitat on the moon, then you would think that those people that are living there have more rights and ability to do stuff with the moon than people that aren't living there. I mean, that's how we've always done conquering in the past.
Yeah, that's how it's worked with Earth, right?
And then, you know, with the superior...
Wait, that's not how we've done conquering in the past. Usually it's just whoever has guns.
Right? Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
It's not whoever's been there longer. So,
I recommend Heinlein's film, The Moon is a... book, The Moon is a Harsh Mistress. It's a great idea colonization of the moon and what kind of social ramifications exist. You know, because the moon has a much less gravitational pull than the Earth. When you're on the moon, you could dominate the Earth in a lot of ways, in a kind of strange way because of gravitational forces.
One thing that he's saying is that any one nation should not own the moon, but multiple entities, groups, individuals, businesses, they should have the opportunity to own the moon.
Sounds like a capitalist to me.
I know. Anyway, but I don't want to just dismiss him, you know,
but isn't also,
like that. So we're going to put the story up on the website if you want to read it.
But you also have other lunar information from China.
Oh, yeah. So China is launching today, I think it is.
Yeah.
It's November 30th. Great.
Amazing.
So China is launching their first lunar lander, and this is not a manned mission, but assuming it happens. Oh, I'm sorry. Sunday evening, so that's going to be. Wait a second. Time zones.
Who knows? At some point in the near future, China will launch a craft that has a robot on it. It will land in like a week, right?
6 p.m. UTC. That's what it's scheduled for. So yeah, it's going to have a little robotic rover. It's going to...
Just like the Mars rovers, right? Same kind of thing.
Yeah, except it's the moon.
Yeah, which is kind of cool.
We've been there. Whatever.
Not at all. It's fantastic.
So anyway, but it looks from where they're spending their money, it looks like they're interested in going to the moon, like really going to the moon and doing things on the moon and everything, unlike the United States, which is like, you know, forget the space shuttle program, forget this, forget that, you know. We've got private industry going to space.
Yeah.
They might end up at the moon at some point.
Moon's got interesting... there's a lot of desire to be in the moon, of course, because of its potential as a station that's mostly outside of orbit of Earth's major gravity well. So that future... space travel makes sense a lot.
It's really easy to blast off.
There's even ice on the moon, so potentially you have fuel capabilities, which is pretty cool. Anyway.
Yeah, and cheese mining. It's really big.
Cheese industry is really scared about moon.
Seriously, but they can't figure out if it's smelly cheese because they can't take off their helmets.
That's right. You'll never know. It could be really delicious.
Hey,
do you know what the filter bubble is, the social filter bubble?
A filter bubble?
Yeah.
Does this have to do with water?
No, this is social networking filter bubble. I'll see if you can backwards engineer just from the term.
I just keep thinking of Brita. Okay, wait. Say it again.
Oh, Swiss cheese. We're talking about cheeses.
What is it? The social engineering...
Well, it's the filter bubble. And the basic... It came into Providence in 2011. And it came from Eli Pariser, who coined the term referring to the way recommendation engines, social recommendation engines, search engines, use your search history and relate you to other people's search history and therefore filter content for you. So we've all familiar with this concept that if you go to Amazon, you start searching for things and then you find an item, it then says people that bought this item also bought these items. That is a situation where it's very relevant to the thing you're searching for. If you're looking for a tent on Amazon, most likely under the filter recommendations of the tent, you're going to see other camping gear. And that makes a perfect sense. You're thinking about camping because you want to buy a tent. Or you're thinking about doing something else. I don't know if you need a tent. But the idea is that a lot of people that buy tents also buy sleeping bags.
Yeah.
So having that relation based off of other people's content is very smart.
Yeah, and that's ultimately what a filter can be, right?
Right.
It's context-aware filter based on the users and based on
things
that the system knows, like the relation between tents and sleeping bags.
And what Eli Pariser kind of suggested was a problem with this idea and why it's become kind of a dominant theme in our society is that it's very possible for these search engines to do this at a social level and therefore filter you from opposing opinion. So if you are looking at camping gear, it totally makes sense. But if you're looking at the statements about a political situation and all you do is look at stuff that are like you, people that look at the same type of content as you, slowly you'll become inside a bubble where you won't see opposing views. Yeah. That is the filter bubble.
So think about Google, right? So Google knows, assuming you use Google as your search engine and presuming that search is basically your gateway to the internet, basically Google knows the websites you tend to go to.
Right.
And so if you go to all leftist, or let's say you're a conspiracy theorist and you go to a lot of conspiracy theory websites, then if you search for 9/11, you're going to get all of the conspiracy links for 9/11. You're going to be basically insulated from the rest of the world and any differing viewpoints.
The example that this researcher first used was people that searched the term BP for British Petroleum. And this was during the time when the Deepwater Horizon oil spill happened. So if you were a type of person that wanted to know about investment information and investing in the market and everything, and you search for BP, you might see stories about investments, in British Petroleum, or how the market was currently varying with regards to investments. But if you were someone that was interested in environmental hazards and environmental impact and social consciousness, then your same search for BP would enlighten you the fact of what environmental hazards of BP were. So therefore, depending on the type of person you had been, you now are more filtered with the content you get. And this is a danger, or so says Pariser. So this has been a problem for a while. I agree, too.
Yeah.
I've actually, one of the students at the Digital Arts and New Media program that I just retired from, took a whole piece about this, looking at different people's search histories and trying to allow you to search as different people. Really cool.
Yeah.
Everybody's Google was the name of the project. But we'll move on.
Wait. I have a question, though. How can I get out of this bubble?
Well, that's the great question, is what do you do about it? And one way to think about it is you could produce a persona that was diametrically opposed to you, but that would be very difficult because you'd have to be outside the bubble to start the persona.
And, of course, it assumes that every bubble thing you're in, there's a dichotomy for it.
Yes.
So there's, leftist and rightist or environmental versus business, but it's not always a dichotomy. It's sometimes there are three or five or 20.
So some researchers at University Pompeu Fabra in Barcelona and Yahoo Labs, about six people, these two different places, have gotten together to try to figure out how to break that bubble. And they're using the own search algorithm to figure out how to get out of it. So the basic idea that they used as their case was really cool. They went ahead and looked in August of September of last year in just the Chile population. They looked for people that had hashtag around pro-choice versus pro-life in Twitter, producing about 40,000 Twitter users who had expressed one of those hashtags. They basically had self-proclaimed themselves. Favorably for one of those attributes, a diametrically opposed political attribute. And then they looked over and only looked at people that had actually posted where they were from, and they filtered down to just Chile. And they got from there about 3,000 Twitter users. Then they took a look at their Twitter traffic and produced a plugin that basically allowed those users, or any user really, to do see recommendations, but also see opposing view recommendations. So you'd have imagine the social network says, you'd probably like this, you probably wouldn't like this. And just in surfacing that gives you a choice to look at the opposing view. It surfaces your opposing view more clearly around that topic point.
That's
pretty cool.
Fantastic.
Huh? Yeah.
That's fantastic because it keeps the benefits of the bubble. Like if you're searching for ecological, with regard to BP, you're not going to be interested in BP business news. But having it there allows you to see the bubble you're in. So that's really, I guess, what it's about, is exposing the fact that you're in a bubble and showing you what the bubble is, rather than having you be in a bubble and not even realize it.
Yeah.
Incidentally, if you want to escape the bubble, you can just open up a new browser that you haven't used, or you can open up an incognito or a private browsing window. So that way, Google, Facebook, whoever, doesn't know who you are, and therefore they can't give you custom recommendations.
Now, granted, though, with that idea, you're not going to get that correlated content, which is actually useful, potentially.
Absolutely.
And so, yeah, that's the definite thing. So this is early research on how to kind of expose that. But what I love about the research of these people did was that they're basically saying, all you have to do is surface what the opposing view is and still let the user decide, but at least acknowledge that there's a possibility of an opposition of your viewpoint.
And, you know, in the past, I've always thought that the solution to this would be to throw the baby out with the bathwater. Basically say, no more personalized recommendations. And that's how a lot of people have addressed it. But that takes away the positive, too. And we have this positive for a reason. I mean, you know, we as consumers like it, so.
Hey, I'm Lyle, and Ben's here with me. In a minute, we're going to talk about some comets, some energy waste, and other stuff about social networks. And stay with us here on GeekSpeak.
KUSP is supported by Mara Software Services. 1,500 software geeks in Western Russia who provide iOS and Android for mobile, machine-to-machine, and embedded software engineering. Details at mera.biz or 650-479-5350.
Here on KUSP, you're listening to GeekSpeak. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark by David Lawrence, used with permission. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Mr. Ben Jaffe. We're talking about geek news this week. We'll be taking your calls in about 15 minutes. The phone number is 888-777-1507. Of course, throughout the week, you can go to geekspeak.org, find out more about what we've done throughout the show, and also ask us questions there, which we address on air sometimes.
Wait, 888 or the 800-655-5877?
That's the one, 800-655-5877. 5877.
Pledge drives mess with us because we
put
up signs.
There's a big sign over there that says a phone number. I just read it.
Yeah.
You're right. If I just said you can call toll free at 1-800-655-5877.
Just closed his eyes.
I just closed my eyes to figure that one out. Exactly. And of course, you can participate in a dialogue on social networking stuff all over the place. We're on Google Plus and Facebook and Twitter and all that things.
You know, speaking of social networking, I mean, there's non-social networkings as well. There's peer-to-peer networkings and everything.
Yep.
Bitcoin has been in the news quite a bit. And I was wondering if we could maybe talk about
Bitcoin.
That. Because,
okay.
Because it's... I've heard it described a number of different ways. You know, like my mom asked, oh, what's Bitcoin at Thanksgiving? And my brother was
we had a Thanksgiving Bitcoin discussion too.
Did you really?
Yeah, absolutely.
And my brother said, oh yeah, it's a online currency for drugs. That's not it. That's not it.
You know, the thing that's so great about it is that it is such, the implementation is so complicated that us geeks, like you and I, have a boundary where we go, how does that work? And we don't know exactly.
Yeah.
You know, we did some research. I did some research about it recently. But basically, Bitcoin, the complexity is so great that to really understand it, there's a level that's not a standard. I don't know how to explain it really well to people.
Well, okay,
I can explain parts of it.
The complexity is really great. That sentence is interesting because it's not so much that Bitcoin is really complicated. It's that take a computer, and a computer runs a loop a million times, and if the number is divisible by 2, it does this. If it's divisible by 5, it does this. If it's divisible by 32, it does this. And then so that's a simple algorithm, but it's really complicated if you try and run through it in your mind and figure out what is the computer doing at all these different steps, because it does a million different things.
So for you to understand Bitcoins, you have to understand some principal concepts, which are themselves really complicated. That's the problem.
But you have to understand
what a hash is. You have to understand what public key, private key is.
Yeah.
And I've talked about these on GeekSpeak a lot. But when you start talking about them, you know, let's say we really want to explain to everybody what public key, private key is, which is a foundational concept that the world relies on at such an intense level. I can't even explain it to everybody, right? You not use the internet without public key, private key working. And yet people don't even really know how it works. So let's talk about that. Well, 20 minutes later, people will go, wow, that's complicated. I still don't know what he's talking about. And I've only described one piece you need to know to understand Bitcoin.
Yeah.
So how do you do it?
But metaphors. I mean, that's how we understand the world anyway, right?
All right.
It's all in metaphors.
And I definitely don't understand the math behind it. I understand metaphorically what the math is doing.
And you trust that the math works because you've seen it work before.
And only because lots of people have tried to poke holes at it. And I kind of believe with the scientific method idea and public and transparency. These algorithms that actually determine this stuff is all open. People inspect it and look at it over and over and over again. And it can be trusted that the math works, which is unfortunately a big starting step.
Yes.
And then again, we trust that 2 + 2 = 4 all the time,
but
even though
we've
never done the proof for it ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And there's, you have to take things as read. Okay.
So
anyway. Which one do you want to hear about first, Ben? Do you want to hear about public key, private key, or hashing?
Oh, gosh. Okay. Let's do a quick metaphorical explanation. And so going through this, there are going to be several times when we say...
Trust it.
And this works because math, you know? It works. I mean, it works because math works, you know? It's like you don't say why is 5
you
times
know what?
6.
If you get lost 30. During this, take a note and you can call in a few minutes and ask us what we did wrong. Because I'd love to hear your question that this brings up. I think that's a great way to do it as well.
Yes.
And kind of wish we had Bonnie here to help out with that too.
And if you have any ideas, if you're a teacher or if you have any ideas like, oh, they could have explained this better this way or that mm-hmm. way, let us know. I mean, I'm a okay. teacher, so I could use the feedback.
So, let's see. If you and I had a code,
yeah.
If you and I had a big number and we wanted to pass information back and forth secretly, we both knew that number.
Normally
privately.
What we would do is we would find a way so no one could see.
Right.
Right.
And you and I would both have a private number and we'd both know what it was. We'd share it. This is symmetric keys. And the idea is that if you have the key and I have the key and then we try to pass things, all we have to do is munch up the information we're trying to pass with that key. A great example of this is if I have a Bible and you have the same printing of the Bible and I can write a sentence and then look in the pages of the Bible, I can find a page number and a paragraph number and a sentence and the first letter
number,
of a word. I can give that number to you to represent the letter A, for example, or the word the. The word the could be multiple pages into a book that both you and I have.
So assuming that we are both on the same page.
Yeah.
No pun intended.
And that's basically the idea is that you and I would both have the exact same key, that book. Big, big, big thing that'd be hard to share. And then once I figured out how to take some content I want to send and encode it into that book, you could then get that weird set of numbers, look through the book, and get back the sentence.
And if someone from the outside was trying to figure out what we were passing back, they would have to guess
it would
this
be a mess.
Huge book, and it wouldn't work.
Now, so it actually would work. That kind of pattern isn't very good because English has certain patterns in it.
If you take that idea and you make it, you know, like really, really,
really
long numbers that are not really guessable, then you end up with a
totally almost, working system.
Almost infinitesimal probability that anyone could possibly guess.
That's
it,
right.
So nobody's going to try.
And
the great thing about that is when you communicate on the internet, everything goes out over
publicly.
Like, yeah, over Wi-Fi, that anyone can grab that. It goes through servers. People who control those nodes could grab that. So having a system that doesn't require nobody else to watch, right? So
right.
having a system that could go and everybody sees it, but nobody can understand it but you and me.
Right.
That's really beneficial.
And in fact, if you ever rely on the transport layer as being the thing that protects you because no one else can see it, you get in a situation that Google currently has. Google has been transferring data between their data centers with what's called a leased fiber line, which means basically it's private. Nobody else can look at it. Unbeknownst to them, the U.S. government has tapped that line and can see all the traffic between the data centers. It's a serious problem. Google's trying to fix it by encrypting all that content. Okay.
Yeah.
So as long as you and I have private ciphers or private keys that no one knows about, and we can pass data that we encrypt, actually people can look at it and it's totally safe. The trick is, how do you and I have a shared key? But more importantly, if I'm communicating with 1,000 people, I'd have to have 1,000 private keys for each one of those people that we would share. And let's say one of those computers was hacked. Now, I don't even know, but I'm actually communicating with and kind of leaking that information. So having this shared secret is actually kind of problematic. But more than that, how do I know you're you on the internet, right? If I look and you are communicating, you know, hey, it's Ben, let's do our secret code handshaking, and we somehow figure out a secret key, how do I know that was actually you the entire time? I don't have your face in front of me. I've got some text that could be forged.
I could be a hologram right now,
right,
even. You know,
it's very unlaquely. You look very much like you, and you're not opaque or not transparent. But
good hologram.
Yeah. So that... There is this problem of identity, and then there's this problem of having this shared secret. So we have other ways to do this. And
there's maybe we should skip
you see what
public
happens?
Private key. But
we need to share. Didn't talk about private public key because it's a fundamental. No.
Well, I mean,
if you want
about the
Bitcoin,
amount of time we have. So basically, the idea is with.
Oh, so that pattern right there is symmetric. You and I have the exact same key.
Yes.
Okay. We encrypt with that key and we decrypt that key. That's called a symmetric cipher.
So, yeah.
An asymmetric cipher, meaning that you have a key that encrypts and I have the key that unencrypts and vice versa, is a very different pattern.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. What this means is that you can publicly share your way to make data safe to you. You can share a public key. I use that public key to encrypt and modify the data and send it to you. And you use the private pair of that key to unencrypt it.
So in other words, anybody who has my public key, which is public, so pretty much anybody.
Anybody can have it.
Anybody can encrypt data that only I can decrypt.
That's right. That is the public key, private key.
So if I want to send something to you, I just grab your public key, which is public, right?
Yeah. It's on my website, actually, at lyle.troxel.com/ego. There's a key there. If you want to encrypt something to me, you grab that, encrypt it, and only I can unread.
I could send you a number. I could send you an image. I could send you a huge block of text. Yep. I could send you the Bible. I could send you whatever.
Additionally,
yeah,
that's one part of the public key, private key. I can share my public key. People can use it to scramble stuff. And the only person that can unscramble that stuff is me because I have the private key.
Cool.
That's the public key, private key. There's a secondary piece of that, which is really cool. I can take my private key, I can take a bit of information, and I can sign that information. Basically, look at that information, what's creating what's called a hash, which is a unique number that only I can generate with my private key. I can send that to you, and using my public key, you can confirm that I was the one that signed it. That's the opposite direction, confirmation of identity.
Yeah. So, exactly. It's confirmation of identity. So that's pretty important. When you're logging into various services, in a way, that's what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So public key, private key. You have your secret and you share your thing publicly. People can give things to you and you can confirm that you are the one that signed stuff.
Yeah.
And with that, Bitcoin is formed.
Exactly. So basically, we have this really awesome foundational idea, the public key, private key idea, which makes us able to, for example, send money back and forth. I can send money to you and other people can verify that that transaction occurred without having either of our private secrets.
Right. And so the general way this happens is if you have, let's say, some money, we'll call it Bitcoin just to be generic.
Sure. Yeah.
You have some Bitcoin money in your wallet. What this means is that at some point, people gave you Bitcoin money and signed it saying that it's for you. Okay, so now let's just say you have Bitcoin. We won't get into how you have it. You have some in your wallet.
And the only thing that makes me have Bitcoin is that, so Bitcoin is an open source and peer-to-peer system. So there are all of these nodes. These nodes exist. They have their own incentives. We're going to talk about that maybe a little bit later. But all these nodes, they all agree that I have 0.1 bitcoins.
Right.
Which is, God, that's like $100.
Yeah. Cool. Let's say you want to give me that 0.1 bitcoin. You want to give that to me.
So everyone agrees that I have it.
Yep. And we'll see how I have it in a second. And then that's how you have it. The same pattern.
Yeah, it's the same pattern. So I create a transaction toward your receiving address and then I kind of send that out to the network and the network will confirm that yes, indeed, that was me who made that transaction.
Right.
And it'll confirm that yes, indeed, it can go to you.
Okay.
And that transaction address works.
And these wallets, basically, this idea of this digital wallet is that public key, private key pair. And what this means is that you have assigned to your public key, you have 0.1 Bitcoin and you want to transfer to me. Mm-hmm. So you get my public key, which anyone can know. And you say, I'm putting this Bitcoin number, this value, to Lyle. And you basically say the transaction is Lyle's public key, 0.1 Bitcoin. And then you, with your private key, you sign it. Okay?
Yeah, I sign it basically saying, I, Ben Jaffe, confirming that this,
So anybody, and then you submit it to this cloud, this giant space where anybody can see it. People can look at it and they go, is that real? And they take a look and they take your public key, which has the ownership of that Bitcoin, and they check to see if you really signed it mathematically, which takes a little processing power. We'll get into why that's important in a minute.
This is the because math works part, right?
Yes. It does work, though. People go, yep, that's confirmed. And other people can then also say, yep, confirmed. Other trusted groups, I've done this.
After a bunch of people confirm your transaction.
So then what's happened is in this very public space, the transaction has occurred that Ben's wallet has transferred money to Lyle's wallet. Now Lyle's wallet clearly has to have money in it because it was transferred from Ben's and that was confirmed. Then that's how we know I have money.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It's very strange.
So if I pull out my wallet, the reason that I know that I have, $20 in here is because I can see a physical object,
right,
a $20 bill in my wallet. It's a departure from that paradigm.
Yes.
It's not that you have a physical object. Your Bitcoin wallet or your Litecoin wallet or your whatever cryptocurrency wallet is not a physical object. It's that public key, private key pair.
Right.
You control your wallet only because you're the only one who has that private key. If anyone else gets your private key, they have access to your wallet. They can transfer your money away to somewhere else. So that's the way this whole owning Bitcoins or Litecoins coins.
And oddly, what it is an entire history of all the transactions of Bitcoins up to that moment has led to the point that you have some. And no one has said with my private key that I'm going to transfer it away. If I destroy and lose my private key, that little bit of Bitcoin you gave me is gone. Because everybody uses this whole system to build this history. It's very much like your checking account. You know, you put money in, you put money out, you put money out in, and therefore there's money in there. It's not like there's really money in it, of course.
Yeah.
It's that we have a history. And this shared history in a Bitcoin space is completely public and confirmed in the public. And so maybe we'll get into that in a second, but we have to take another break.
Oh, gosh, we do. Here's the forward promote I don't want people knowing how much money I have. So
that's
how
a good
do
point.
We how do yeah. we deal with that? So we're going to talk about that in just a sec.
Hey, you're listening to Geek Speak on KUSP. I'm Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Mr. Ben Jaffe. We're talking about Bitcoins, trying to explain a pretty technical and complicated process and to everybody.
Not just Bitcoins, all cryptocurrencies. Actually, most cryptocurrencies work on these same basic principles.
Right. So to just sum up, it's not that you have anything, but you have a history that leads to you having something. And that history is completely public and confirmed by all the users that use the system.
So my question is, gosh, that seems kind of scary if everybody knows how much money I have or I don't have. And it turns out that there are actually two reasons that that's not really a problem. First of all, you don't have your name connected to your Bitcoin wallet. So there's a Bitcoin wallet, let's say address 1234. Now, the addresses are way, way longer. Like, there are more possible addresses than there are subatomic particles in the universe. But let's say my Bitcoin address is 1234. So address 1234, nobody knows who owns that address because the only reason I own the address is that I have the private key to it.
Yeah.
So nobody knows who has the private key to wallet 1234. Everyone knows
how much money's in wallet 1234.
Exactly. The other thing is, it's typically good practice whenever you receive money from anybody to give them a different address. So your Bitcoin wallet is not so much a single address. It's a collection of addresses. And you can have as many addresses as you want because of what I just said. There are more addresses than subatomic particles in the universe. So you can just burn right through them. So that's the idea. That's why nobody knows how many Bitcoins I have.
I have a Bitcoin wallet on my computer, and that wallet is a number, and that's all it is. And if I investigate the cloud and find out, I can find out how much money is in that wallet.
Mm-hmm.
My machine currently hasn't downloaded that entire library. In fact, there's kind of a problem right now because Bitcoins are so successful.
Yeah.
The current history of all Bitcoin transactions is about 11 terabytes.
Terabytes?
So, gigabytes?
Gigabytes.
No, I think, is it?
It's
only
gigabytes.
Okay, so it's pretty big.
Yeah.
Yeah. But
because I considered downloading it. If it was 11 terabytes, I
wouldn't
have considered
it. Yeah, that's right, 11 gigabytes. But it will grow over time. It will get larger and larger.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Okay, so that's where the privacy comes from. You can create a wallet. In fact, you and I, if I had a Bitcoin in a wallet, I could just give you that wallet number.
Yeah.
And you could do with what you will. Of course, until you transfer it away, it's possible for me to do something with it too. So we could actually have a shared wallet as well.
Yeah.
But also, if you get some money from somebody, you could create 7 wallets, put a little bit in each one of them. That would be publicly transferring between these public things. And then you could use those wallets to do other things. Now, the tracking of that is potentially dangerous in the sense that it is possible to identify somebody and where they are by their IP address online. So there also is a possibility of just having kind of a centralized hub where you'd transfer money in, you'd get a fee, and they'd give you money again in a different wallet, and no one would know that it was still you that had it.
Yeah,
that kind of banking thing could happen too.
You can create wallets on computers that don't have access to the internet. That's another way to prevent being tracked or any of that stuff.
Yeah.
Getting money out of Bitcoin. That's a good question. It's like, how do you get money into Bitcoin? How do you get money out of Bitcoin? There are all of these places which will take money. You can send them money from your bank account, and then they'll give you bitcoins or vice versa. Right. They're called exchanges. They're also exchanges.
Just like currency exchange between different currencies.
Yeah, exactly.
Real currencies, yeah.
And they're also currency exchanges where you can trade, say, bitcoins for feather coins or for light coins or for any of
these other currencies.
Tons of coins.
What I find fascinating is when I talk to people about this, relatively quickly, somebody will be joining me in the conversation will say, yeah, but... And someone will say, well, that's just digital currency. It's just about trust. And then someone says, yeah, but so is the U.S. dollar. Like,
yeah,
all
so
these currencies
money.
Are the same. And then instead of getting to the point of going, ooh, cool, Bitcoin, trustworthy, what I feel like in general people get to is, oh, our financial system's all based off of trust. But I kind of love that idea that we all just kind of accept that this is reality, so we're going to move forward with that.
But
it's laws works that way too, right? Everything works that way. And all social contracts work with this idea that, well, I'm part of the society and that's what the society's agreed upon and therefore it works.
Yeah. And when people lose faith in a currency, of course it crashes. That's what happened, with the Great Depression. Everyone was like, actually, maybe the dollar isn't worth so many. I should get my money out now, or the banks rather. One of the great things about Bitcoin and these other cryptocurrencies as well, just in terms of brief differences, changes, and benefits, are that it's completely decentralized. So the U.S. government or whoever can't just say, you know what, Bank of America, go ahead and suspend this user's account. They're doing illicit things with it or whatever. Or, they're an enemy of the state or whatever. If you have your money, you have your money. Everyone will agree.
If you control your secret key, you control the wallet that has that money.
And the only way to change that is if you, whoever entity who is shutting someone down, controls more than half of all of the miners and all of the pools across the internet. And that's...
Ooh, even more like 80%, I think, is the general rule.
I think it's 50. The general rule is 80, but theoretically you could do 50. There were some people who were saying, maybe if you did 33%, you could kind of...
The thing is,
sequester it. But the idea is...
The nodes are dynamically generated, and it's more complicated than that, unfortunately. I want to first welcome people. I know that Ben and I are geeking out. I get that he and I are just going blah, 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 and talking about tech and cipher keys and all this stuff. And we totally are aware at this moment, we know what we're talking about. But that doesn't help you very much. So if you have a question, a clarity, want to know a little bit more about what we just said and try to explain it, or maybe have a metaphor that will really help people understand it, please give us a call. 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877.
So the last question that pops into my mind is all these people who are verifying transactions and solving these math problems to get, what is their incentive, right?
And so, the other one that's kind of begging is, wait, who made up where'd the coins come from in the first place?
Yeah. So
we won't talk about where the coins originate from, but we will talk how coins get transferred around at a really interesting way. And that's this, that this giant history of transactions is public. But the time to figure out if Ben actually transferred money to Lyle, the way to do that is to look at his public key, take a look at the signature on that transaction, and check it. And that actually takes a little bit of processing power.
Yeah, that's called verification.
Verification. When you do millions of verifications, you then could sign, somebody could sign that verification package, that chain of verification. They could confirm that these Bitcoins have traveled in this way. So what happens in this system is that as those big, larger blocks are confirmed, this giant transaction history is kind of confirmed by people in this slow process, if you will, you produce what's called a blockchain. And that whole block of all these different transactions gets signed. And the company that does that and gets chosen as the one that does that gets some Bitcoin. Because in that transaction history, some Bitcoins are being conserved, if you will. Some taxes.
Consider it a transaction fee. So, when you buy something with a credit card, it's 3% plus 25 cents or something like that. It's relatively high. If you're a small taqueria, that might be a good portion of your profit margin, right? But that's the cost of doing the transaction.
Right.
That's probably quite a bit higher than it needs to be in terms of the amount of work the credit card company is doing.
Yeah.
So with Bitcoin, you can take your transaction and you can say, 6 cents. You get 6 US dollar cents or, some fraction, small fraction of a Bitcoin if you verify this transaction.
Now, the algorithms that define all this is all codified, meaning there's programs that's an open source program that defines this entire system. And that program has in it the rules to do the reimbursement of the transactions. So all of the software that runs this stuff is all playing by the same rule, and it signs the rule that it's made with these signatures, with this encryption signatures, which then confirms that they played this right rule. And because everybody's doing that, the system itself takes care of those fees. There's no body that does it. It's the software that everybody's agreed will be real has done it.
It's all these people agreeing.
It's all the software agreeing. Yeah.
Yeah. If some software disagrees, starts playing by different rules, they'll just be ignored.
Their signatures will basically be noise. They'll say, nope, nobody can confirm
actually,
that.
That's not right. Yeah. You got one confirmation on your transaction, but you know what? That's not
enough.
Valid.
Right.
Because I didn't get
so
a transaction.
The more people that play the system, the more people that add to the system that do this work, the harder it is to fool the system because the system self-corrects.
There's one more incentive.
And it's all algorithmic. It's not based off of trust in the sense that it's confirmed and the confirmation is the thing that makes sure that it's okay. It's strange.
This is another one of the because math moments. It works because math. The other incentive, just very briefly, is that Bitcoins actually come from solving very difficult math problems. Just, you know, oversimplify it a little bit, but basically you're solving these SHA-hashes. And if you solve these SHA-hashes and you're the first one to solve the SHA-hash, the math problem, and then everybody verifies that, yes, indeed, you solved the problem before anyone else, you get the Bitcoin that is mined, I'm putting that in air quotes there, that is mined or uncovered from that. And typically, you get 25 Bitcoins every 10 minutes. That's what the rules of the system and the math works out to. So as more people try and mine, the difficulty in mining goes up. So the issuance of Bitcoins will always be 25 Bitcoins every 10 minutes. In 2017, it'll be 12.5 Bitcoins. And there will never, ever be more than, I think it's 13 million Bitcoins.
Now there's two ways to mine, actually, Ben. And that's the thing that's a little confusing.
21 million, sorry.
There's two ways to mine Bitcoins. There's the generating, finding the number, the hard math problem. And then there's this confirmation block thing.
Yeah.
And those both produce new Bitcoins at the same type of rate that you're talking about.
Yeah. So that brings up an interesting, another difference between our normal financial system and Bitcoins or other cryptocurrencies is that it's a deflationary currency. So you can't just decide, oh yeah, I'm the one who prints US dollars. I'm going to print more because we need more.
Right.
That devalues every US dollar on the market by, you know, whatever that ratio is of the amount that you printed versus the amount that there already are. With Bitcoins, you just cannot print more than that many million. It's mathematically impossible.
So. Now, there's an Economist article from a few days ago that talks about Bitcoin, and it's kind of spread a lot of this talk recently about Bitcoin. And it's pretty negative in a lot of ways. It talks about Bitcoin being very much like what was the first Napster, the music sharing thing.
Yeah.
It's not really fair. I think it's kind of downside of it. But then again, the Economist is for bankers, so who knows? But one of the things they talk about is the amount of power that the current system has. What's been happening is because you can spend processing power and actually make money from that, people are investing in tech to do this. At first, it was computers, home computers.
Yeah,
then
first
it was
you just
graphics
use your,
cards.
Your process. So you
right.
could, you used to be able to do your processor.
Yep.
And you would get a Bitcoin every once
week
in a while
or so. Yeah.
But then,
and then people started making kind of pseudo supercomputers with graphics cards. Then people went into hardware level computers.
Mm-hmm.
Now the amount of processing power that's involved in Bitcoin systems is 50,000 petaflops. It's 100 times faster than the top 500 supercomputers combined. So you take the 500 supercomputers combined that we publicly know about, mostly at universities, you add them together, the Bitcoin power is 500 or 100 times more than that.
Oh,
it is the
God.
Biggest supercomputer on the planet.
That's...
And all it's doing is math. Confirming cool. financial transactions, which I think is pretty
so
awesome.
If anyone said math didn't have any intrinsic value, that is completely wrong.
Nicely done, sir. Nicely done. Wow, we're running short. You want to do one more story? Because I think we covered that enough.
I guess so. Let me see. What else do I have to cover? So server energy waste. Speaking of energy waste, right. There is a story that I have somewhere. Oh, yeah. Basically, the activity that servers, for example, Google uses in servers, that amount of energy that runs Google servers could power a city of 750,000 people. That's
Whoa.
Bigger than Boston, Seattle,
Wow.
Denver. globally, power consumption at data centers rose by 63% last year. So it's 38 gigawatt hours. That's an immense amount of energy. That's the amount of energy New Zealand makes or Colombia makes. So we kind of have to think about power usage. And so a lot of these companies are trying to find, you know, more power-friendly ways of doing their things.
So, and I'll push one thing. I no longer work at UCSC, University of California, Santa Cruz, so I feel totally fine at saying, hey, there's an art show coming up next week.
Those are neat.
Yeah, they are cool. It's the Danham Open Studios, fall 2013. This is the place I used to work. You'll probably see me there from like noon to 2, but the show goes on next Friday, December 6th, from 12 o'clock to 4 o'clock officially, but I think it's going to go later than that. And basically, it's a whole bunch of digital art, and that's the same time as the print sale, and the whole arts division does stuff at UCSC. So if you want to walk the grounds and run into a geek and see some cool tech art, see me next week at UCSC, December 6th, from 12 to 4. That's where I'll be.
Hey, I want to go. How much are tickets?
It's free.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Hey, this is Geek Speak. I'm Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Mr. Ben Jaffe, answering phones, which I guess we didn't really do. Is Rick, thanks for being in there to do that. If you have questions for us throughout the week, you're welcome to give us a call virtually through email. Just go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us, or send us a note through Facebook or Twitter or Google Plus. Hey, the more you like us on those things, the more people find out about our show. We love that you're listening to the program, and we love doing the program. Geek Speak is a volunteer endeavor. It's also Creative Commons, share and share alike. And Ben and I don't get paid. We just love doing this. So we'll see you next week.
See ya.